welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a look at air safety in Indonesia. We'll hear about developing drones to help fight wildfires.
There's no human pilot in the seat. There's no human crew. And so we can go into areas where we already send manned aircraft, but where those missions have a lot of risk.
A psychiatrist speaks with us about the practice of ghosting and a discussion of a songwriter whose work you probably know, but whose name you probably don't. It's right here on The Voice of America. Rescuers are responding to the apparent crash site of a twin-engine European-built ATR-42-300 aircraft operated by the Indonesian carrier Trigana Air Service, which disappeared in mountainous terrain on a flight from the Papua provincial capital, Jayapura, to Aksibil with 54 people. The plane was also carrying nearly $500,000 for remote villages of the eastern province. My colleague Victor Beatty has been following this story and joins me now here in the studio. Victor, what have you found out?
Hello, Susan. Well, the loss of the Trigana flight is the latest aviation disaster suffered by Indonesia. Back in December, an AirAsia jet crashed in the Java Sea, killing all 162 people aboard. Last month, a military transport C-130 aircraft crashed in Medan, killing 142. Trigana has been on the European Union's list of banned carriers since 2007 over safety and regulatory concerns. Jeffrey Thomas, editor of the Australian website AirlineRatings.com, told me the aircraft is a reliable one used worldwide as a regional carrier.
The area where this is being used is one of the most inhospitable, very mountainous. The airport it was headed for is called Aksibil. It's right in the mountainous area of Indonesian Papua. And the airline itself, Trigana Air Service, formed in 1991. And it's had now 15 accidents, 11 serious accidents, of which 5 involved fatalities. So it's had a very checkered record. However, its main operation area is within this mountainous region of Indonesia. And unfortunately, you're talking high mountains, very bad weather, and you're also talking limited navigation aids, not the sort of thing we in the United States or in Australia are used to. So not a very good cocktail, unfortunately.
Did weather play a factor, do you think, in this crash?
Our understanding from reports on the ground is that the weather was a major factor. It almost is a factor every day. There's usually thunderstorms every afternoon in this particular area, and it was reported that was the case yesterday.
Reports indicate this aircraft was 27 years old. Is that very old for an aircraft to be in flight?
Aeroplanes can be 27, 37, and even 47 years old. As long as they're maintained well and kept up to date, then some of these airframes can last 50 or even 100 years. They're very robust. But it really depends on the maintenance level. I don't believe the age of the plane was a factor in this case. Putting together what we do know, bad weather, I think it's highly likely that this was a situation awareness where the pilots lost their bearings, so to speak, put it simply, and took a left turn instead of a right turn and slammed into a mountainside.
What do you make of the EU's ban of Trigana? Is it an unsafe carrier?
Well, the EU ban, to clarify it for listeners, relates to the Indonesian government's oversight of its aviation industry. They did an audit, and they do audits every number of years of countries, including the United States, of its oversight of its airline industry. In the case of Indonesia, it failed all 8 criteria. There's 8 different areas like air navigation, airports, legislation, air crash investigation. There's 8 different bodies they do audits of, and it failed. It was below the world average in every single one, and in some cases only 20% compliant. And that's what the EU goes on. They look at that and they say, look, Trigana Air Service and most of the airlines in Indonesia are banned from flying to Europe. There are some exceptions, like Garuda Indonesia, very good airline. They're not banned from flying to Europe, but it relates basically to the oversight of the industry by the government.
How would you rate Indonesia's aviation record?
Unfortunately, it's not very good at all. And this is a real tragedy because aviation is terribly important to Indonesia. Indonesia itself is made up of 11,000 islands. Not all, of course, are inhabited, but a large number are inhabited. So a good air service is terribly important. And unfortunately, their track record is not good at all. Multiple crashes every year, many involving fatalities. And it certainly it hampers the development of the country. It also is an impediment to tourism as well.
Thomas says the Asian aviation picture is a mixed one, with Singapore, China, and Japan having the best safety records, while the carriers of other nations, such as Myanmar, also known as Burma, Cambodia, Laos, Indonesia, and the Philippines, far less so.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchewski with a look at what is being said today in social media. Andrew, what's going on?
Well, the Indonesian plane crash is one of the top trending topics in the news, breaking this morning that there was over $500,000 worth of aid for poor families on the flight. So a lot of people seizing on this, saying, what happened to the money? Is it still there? Did it get burned up maybe in the crash, or if there wasn't any kind of explosion, the money could still be around.
But a lot of people be blowing around if it's not in the safe or something.
Exactly. So a lot of people asking those questions, and other people striking back and saying, oh, well, we still have a loss of human life, so we should focus on that. But still a lot of questions surrounding this crash. And as they come out, I'm sure to see people reacting to that on social media.
Right, more tweets?
Yes, absolutely. Hashtag Modi in Dubai is also trending this morning. Prime Minister Modi of India is making a trip to the United Arab Emirates. First time an Indian prime minister has been there in over three decades. What I found interesting with this hashtag is people reacting to his visit, but people also giving things like traffic tips. He's giving a speech, and the traffic is all tied up in Dubai. So people are saying, here's how you can get around it, and using social media as
this
back channel. So it's a nice way to use that to help other people and to get around some of the congestion and share some information. Of course, people sharing pictures as well and other tidbits from his speeches and his events throughout UAE. And then finally, Twitter is letting people expound a little bit more when they send out direct messages. They're taking out the 140-character limit for direct messages and raising it to 10,000 characters. They're keeping it the same for tweets. Tweets will still be 140 characters. But the idea behind this is that a lot of companies use Twitter as customer service, and they're saying now people can get these messages from companies, airlines, and what have you, and they don't have to be jammed into 140 characters.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew, for
thank
your
you.
Insight. Appreciate it, as always. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
It's tough for male elephant seals to find and attract a female mate during breeding season. It turns out that the competition for a lady elephant seal's attention is pretty stiff. While somewhat rare, very violent, bloody fights do break out between the opponents vying for the affection of a particular female. The male elephant seal mostly likes to make a lot of noise and stir up commotion by arguing and posturing among other rival males to attract a mate. But a new study by researchers at the University of California at Santa Cruz has found that the males also develop a natural form of voice recognition. They learn to recognize the unique call of their adversaries so that they can decide whether they should engage in a brutal fight or avoid confrontation by fleeing. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Unmanned aerial vehicles have become a hot topic and a valuable tool for a variety of reasons. Now, the Desert Research Institute in Nevada has launched a program in conjunction with NASA to develop the use of unmanned aircraft systems, called UAS, to locate, manage, and fight wildfires. International Edition's Jeffrey Young looked into this development. Thanks for joining us here in the studio, Jeff.
Hi, Susan. The lead researcher for DRI for this project is Adam Watts. He says there is a lot of good use for these unmanned aircraft in fighting wildfires and hopefully saving lives in the process.
My great area of interest is using unmanned aircraft systems to observe wildfires, so that we can see where they're moving, so that we can protect life and property and increase the safety of firefighters who are combating those wildfires or bushfires. And we can also use instruments that we put on those unmanned aircraft to observe the fire, to sample smoke, and to do some really fantastic research projects by making observations that really haven't been possible before. That's something we're really excited about.
Why weren't they possible? We have fixed-wing aircraft. We have helicopters. You can fly over a wildfire. You can observe things. You can report back to the ground. What is different about using unmanned aircraft systems versus manned regular planes and helicopters?
Well, that's a really good question, and there's been a lot of great work that has been done with manned aircraft and helicopters and really has inspired the kinds of projects that have been done and that we are working on doing with unmanned aircraft. But they do have some advantages, and we're looking to exploit those advantages. For one thing, because they're unmanned, there's no human pilot in the seat, there's no human crew, and so we can go into areas where we already send manned aircraft, but where those missions have a lot of risk. So we can reduce the risk and thereby increase the safety aspect. We can also deploy them in locations such as nighttime flights over fires, where manned aircraft are not prohibited currently to fly over fires in the United States, at least. So that's another area where we can get information that we've not been able to get before.
Tell me about the NASA aspect. Why are they jumping in on this project with DRI?
Well, for one thing, NASA have been leaders in aerospace technology for decades, since their formation. And we have the great fortune of close proximity geographically to the NASA Ames Research Center, where, along with NASA Dryden, there has been a lot of leadership in the area of using unmanned aircraft for scientific observations, particularly over wildfires. So we're drawing on their experience and expertise, and we like to think that we also provide some advantages to them as well, because Nevada has been designated one of our six national test sites for unmanned aircraft. So it's really a great collaboration, and we think that's going to provide a lot of good synergy going forward.
That was Adam Watts with the Desert Research Institute in Reno, Nevada.
Quite a development. I hope it works out. Thanks for that report, Jeff.
It's an interesting story, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, ghosting, it's not what goes bump in the night, and a musical superstar whose name you might not know. The practice of ghosting is becoming more prevalent in social and business situations. Some consider it rude, others a considerate way to avoid unpleasantness. On the line with us is psychiatrist Dr. Nzinga Harrison. Welcome, doctor, to our program.
Thank you.
Could you please explain to us just what is ghosting?
Sure. So ghosting is when someone completely disappears from a relationship with no notice at all. So it comes from kind of like Casper the Ghost. One minute you see him, one minute you don't. And when people leave a relationship, leaving the other person to wonder what in the heck happened, you try to call, you try to text, you try to email, and the other person is literally just dropped off the face of the earth, you've been ghosted.
Now, this can be a personal relationship, but it also sometimes happens in business.
It does, which is incredible to me because the old adage, you know, don't burn your bridges, pretty much flies out the window when you ghost a business relationship. But business relationships, especially when, you know, maybe there's contention over finances, can be as difficult to navigate conflict as personal relationships. And that's really the basis for ghosting, is the ultimate avoidance of conflict.
Is it rude or a considerate way to handle awkward situations?
It's rude. So anyone who says this is a considerate way to handle an awkward situation has never been ghosted. We are a society that really kind of emphasizes this aspect of closure and being able to know what happened and, you know, knowing the role that we played in relationships that ended. And when you ghost someone, whether for business or personal reasons, you really remove the ability for that person to know what happened and leave them in a state of limbo. So it's really a very, very passive, aggressive, hostile, mean thing to do.
Yeah.
In no way is it courteous.
hurt your feelings. Well, why does this practice, why is it rising in our culture?
You know, I think there are a couple of reasons why it's rising. One that people commonly point to is technology, but from an angle maybe that people don't really consider. So like the Facebooks and the Twitters and the Instagrams, et cetera, I'm too old to know what all of them are these days, really allow us to be connected to more people that are not in our immediate geographic space. And so before, it would be difficult to ghost someone because you would probably run into them at the grocery store, or you would see them at work, or you would see them at church, or you would see them at the football game on Saturday. Now with all of these social media connections where we have relationships over longer distances that really require that we're proactive about seeing people face-to-face, you can ghost from an electronically based relationship and never have to worry about kind of the discomfort of running into that person unplanned.
I'm wondering if all the social media business is making us a little insensitive because we're not having eye-to-eye contact. We're not touching or shaking hands. We're dealing with a machine, after all. And some people deal with the machine all the time and really don't have an interaction with another human or another animal.
I completely agree with you because when you're in a room, right, eye contact actually affects you physiologically, biologically. You get processes through your body, you know, your heart beats, your stomach responds. You can feel the way a person breathes. You're connected through pheromones. And all of that is lost over the technical relationship. All of those things serve to connect us even more and to make it even more difficult to be mean to a person, which is what ghosting is. Ghosting is just being mean. When you're over the computer, you don't have those same biological signals that drive you away from that aggressive act. And so it's much easier to just cut it off and go about your way.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us, Doctor. And it's an interesting phenomenon.
It is. It is.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Decades, some of the most successful songwriters have been very well heard, but lived in relative obscurity. David Byrd and Ray McDonald talk about the latest superstar you likely have never heard of.
You know his work, but you might not know his name. Max Martin has put the pen to paper and written a slew of number ones. Ray, this guy's got things that he's written, Taylor Swift's Bad Blood. He's also written the current number one song, right?
Can't Feel My Face by The Weeknd. I love talking about this guy because he's such a phenomenon and nobody outside the music industry knows him. Max Martin from Sweden. Can't Feel My Face is his 21st number one single on the Hot 100 as a songwriter. It's his 19th as a producer. Only Lennon and McCartney top him in the songwriter category. And he is second as a producer behind George Martin, who did the Beatles.
'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. You know it used to be mad love. So take a look what you've done. 'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. Hey, now we got problems. And I don't think we can solve them. You made a really deep cut. And baby, now we got bad blood. Hey.
So what other songs has he done that our audience knows about, besides Bad Blood and Can't Feel My Face?
Well, Max Martin started his run of number ones here in the States back in 1999 with Baby One More Time. And he's really caught fire since 2008. 17 of his 19 chart-topping production hits have happened in the past 7 years. And as I say, Can't Feel My Face is his second number one hit of 2015, following Bad Blood.
Does he write these solo, or does he collaborate with people, or both?
He generally collaborates with people. The Weeknd actively collaborated in writing Can't Feel My Face. Generally, Max Martin will do the bulk of the songwriting for his clients, but The Weeknd really insisted on having a bigger say.
Now, is he lyrics and music, or just lyrics, or what?
Well, generally it's lyrics and music, and he started out in Sweden's public music education programs when he was a boy, and he has gone out of his way to thank them for his success. And that's worth noting, because in many parts of the United States, these public music programs are either gone or endangered.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, music and arts, and sadly, sports sometimes are the first couple of things to go away.
That's exactly right.
When the emphasis is on what they call STEM, like science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and getting test scores. But creative arts sometimes is the first thing to suffer. And yet guys like this get their whole life out of a public education. Well, all right, if you have any comments about Max Martin, about some of the tunes he's written, or anything else you hear on our program, you can send us a tweet. We're at @VOA_IE. You can also send Ray a tweet at a couple of places. One, @RayOnTheHits, and that's his personal account. And you can also send it to @VOA_music. And if you want to hear Ray count down the top 20 or the top 5 songs every week, log on to www.voanews.com.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The global movement to bring Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army to justice has reached the halls of Congress. More than a dozen members of the U.S. House of Representatives have joined together to introduce a bipartisan resolution condemning Kony and the LRA for continuing to perpetrate crimes against humanity. A similar measure is being considered in the Senate, endorsing current U.S. efforts to support members of the African Union Regional Task Force in hunting down Kony's guerrilla army. It also pledges continued congressional support for U.S. military advisors working with those nations in the region. On August 10th, lawmakers were briefed on efforts to track down and eliminate the LRA and heard testimony from non-governmental organizations that have been working to raise public awareness and assure accountability for atrocities committed by the group. Kony was indicted in 2005 by the International Criminal Court in The Hague, but has evaded capture ever since. For more than two decades, his small, ruthless armed band has terrorized large areas of Uganda, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, South Sudan, and Central African Republic, forcing some 465,000 people to flee their homes. Uganda, where the group originated, and its neighboring countries have struggled for years to counter the LRA. With the support of the African Union, the United Nations, the United States, and other international partners, efforts to end the group's depredations against civilians have seriously weakened, but not yet completely eliminated, the group. The congressional action shows once again that our country stands with the governments and the people of Central Africa in their efforts to neutralize the LRA. We call on LRA fighters to put down their arms, leave the organization's ranks, and come home. We will continue to work with the governments in the region to ensure that low-level fighters and abductees who escape from the LRA are able to reunite with their families and reintegrate into normal society.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.